work session on the insurance pool governing board, which is House Bill 5035. I think they, earlier this session they were before our committee, and so today we'll be having the work session. And so Peggy, I will sort of hand it off to you, and you can explain for us the handout.
You should have a three-page spreadsheet on the insurance pool governing board, and then some proposed amendments to the bill. There are only two changes. The first program, if you'll remember, it's been a long time since we heard this budget. I think it was the first one that we heard back in January. The insurance pool governing board has two budget programs, the all employer health insurance, or AKA marketing, outreach, and education. Sometimes it's called one thing, sometimes the other, but it does relate to small business insurance and making health insurance available to persons who are employed by small businesses. The first package, the governor had recommended a current discount package, but the first page, small business employer insurance page. The governor had recommended a current service level budget. This is a small program, as you know, and our recommendation is that you have the 20% efficiency reductions associated with service supplies, personal services, and capital outlays, and so we'd recommend that that program be approved with those 4% reductions.
And so that's on our second?
That's on the second sheet. That provides a general fund budget of $495,772. On the other funds, expenditure limitation of $50,468. And there are no federal or tobacco tax in that budget. And that's maintenance of existing two FTE. These are marketing positions. The administration of the insurance governing board is shared with staff at the Office of Oregon Medical Insurance School Board in DCBS. So there are only these two marketing positions here.
Okay.
The last page shows the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. Our recommendation is that in order to stay within the budget parameters, that you reduce the expenditures for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program by $3 million. We are not recommending that you terminate the program, that you simply allow the board the discretion to operate with $3 million fewer dollars, and that they, in doing so, we're also recommending that you not cap enrollment, and that you not put any particular constraints on the whether there is an 85% match or a 95% match or whatever, but that the board be empowered as it has been in the past to set up the rules of the program in a way that they can maximize the delivery of service to the low-income persons that this is aimed at. In this way, the board has the ability to number one, to reduce its administrative costs to the extent that it possibly can, to maximize employer contributions to the extent that it can, and to maximize the availability of federal CHIP money to the extent that it can, and then to maintain the program at the highest possible level within the recommended resources.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Shields.
Given what you've just said, and given my understanding that there's some 14,000 people, if I'm right, on the EF waiting list, what's going to happen to those people?
Those people would... That depends on how the board restructures the program or addresses the budgetary issue, but they would presumably, and Rocky King is here, he could address that, but that presumably they would wait a little longer before they were eligible if everything were maintained as it is. I think the dropout rate from natural attrition has been in the area of around 1.5 to 2%. And so as those people dropped off, if the board were able within the existing resources to maintain the same level of service through the maximizing of CHIP money and employer contributions, then it would simply mean a slower, depending on how they're able to function, it would be a slower ability to for new people to come into the program.
A waitlist particularly to me represents a kind of a commitment, you know, at least you're on the waiting list, you build up your hopes. And so I guess I'd like to ask Rocky if you really think you can get to that 14,000 people this way, or what's going to happen?
Rocky, I guess while Rocky is coming forward, I would remind you, if you read the paper, Senator Steele, that we're doing a good thing here.
Mm-hmm.
This program was actually headed for the chopping block. Rather than eliminating the 14,000 plus however many you're covering right now, we're at least going to be able to continue the program, which I'm very delighted about. It is a good program and it does help people.
Okay. And Chair, Senator Shields, to answer your question, we have about 6,500 people that we anticipate will be enrolled, 6,100 that are enrolled now, and another 400 or 500 that are in the process of obtaining health insurance, with about 14,000 people on the waiting list. As soon as our waiting list got above 4,000 or 5,000, we've always said that we didn't think we would have enough money, even if under the governor's recommended budget, to serve all of those people. So we have then tried to do communications to them to let them know that the length of time before the program would be able to serve them is going to be much longer. Depending on how the board would restructure under this program, and there are some options that it has to try to maintain 6,500 as opposed to just to drop 750 off of it to make up for the 3 million. Depending on how it's restructured, I would envision that there would be possibly a 1,000 to 2,000 of those 14,000 that we could hopefully serve if you just did our natural attrition over the period of the next year. Dropping that 3 million doesn't really get you to that 14,000th person anyway. There's always going to be a greater need out there. There's about 130,000 people in that income level that in one way or another may meet that eligibility criteria. This program was initially established really to get a foothold in that. But at the same time, in you know, recognizing what issue you're bringing forward, does it represent some discouragement for a lot of Oregonians? Sure it does. But at the same time, if we're able to maintain the 6,500, which I think is a big challenge for the board, with a cut like that, that will at least help dent some of that discouragement for a lot of Oregonians.
Any other questions?
Representative Robeck. Yeah, sure. I was just going to say that, you know, I think this was pretty much assumed, just sort of picking up on your comments, that this was assumed in most of the early budgets. Scenarios that I saw, this program was not going to be continued at all because it is a $20 million bottom line hit to the general fund, and because there aren't federal funds available on a matching basis as there are for many other programs. So I think this is, in fact, I think I even talked to Rossi at one point and said that my understanding is the program was going to be eliminated, and so this is quite a turnaround to have it back there.
Madam Chair. I was just picking up something here. It says that this pertains to individuals in low-income households that earn too much to qualify for Medicaid but not enough to afford their employer's health benefit coverage. What do we mean by that, not enough to afford? If it's a benefit from the employer, are we saying that it's not a benefit from the employer, that they're paying for it, or that they're choosing not to take it? I don't understand that.
Madam Chair, Representative Locum, I gave an example. 2 nights ago, I sat down in the evening with a young woman in her early 20s filling out a FEOP application. She makes $7.25 an hour and has one child. She pays approximately $380 a month on daycare. She's not a part of any public assistance program except a WIC program to help her on her formula. Her employer is going to charge her share, $164 for health insurance. She's worked full-time for 4 years. making $1,000 a month and coming up with an additional $164 is tough for those folks. So what the subsidy does is help them pay their share. It's then matched with the employer's share. So one of the benefits of the program is that there is employer dollars, the individual dollars, as well as state dollars. We're really leveraging those together.
So but you're saying that the employer pays something that he didn't pay for the full family coverage.
That says, look, and that is correct. The employers, if you look at our program, pay for employer-based coverage about an average of $50 to $60 per enrollee out of employer funds that are enrolled in the group market.
And one more follow-up. In some of the information I've seen, there's a percentage of people that choose not to take insurance. And I wonder if those people who make that choice on their own, but perhaps decide they'll have to get a car, or they have to do something for the house, or they have to do this or that, and so they choose not to take insurance. I wonder if those people are included in this group that you say are uninsured.
Madam Chair, Representative Locum, of course, there's a number of the people in our 11% uninsured in the state are, who are, can afford the health care if they so chose to purchase it. That's why I think we've always said that if we could get down to 4 or 5% uninsured on a voluntary basis, that was a pretty good objective to get into single digits in the uninsured rate. You know, the young and healthy, the friends are invincible, and they're not going to purchase it even if they have the funds. But that is not who the target of this population generally is. And when you look at the demographics, you're talking about a large number of older females who work in low-income jobs, who have health conditions but don't qualify for Medicaid and go into a high-risk pool but hadn't before because they couldn't afford the premium. And the other large group are single mothers with one or two children that, again, are working full-time but can't, so they're not eligible for Medicaid. They can't afford coverage themselves.
Madam Chair, I understand that, but I also understand that we use big figures sometimes, and they're a little misleading, and they make us feel more guilty than we need to feel. Because people make their own choices a lot of time and put different priorities. So I'm pleased that we can help the kind of person that this is targeted at, and that's what we should help. But not to get too involved in those massive figures that they've made their choices and we can't.
I apologize to you if you feel too guilty.
Thank you.
One more question. If the insurance pool governing board is able to get federal waivers to use CHIP dollars for more children, would you then be able to come to the e-board to increase your expenditure limit somehow?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, our plan all along, if you recall the first budget session, has been that $1 million is kind of a placeholder amount.
Mm-hmm.
Once we get through, hopefully working with DHR and the Office of Health Plan Administrator and the federal government to frame a program that's focused on children and families that would be eligible for the CHIP dollars, then we would come back to the e-board to try to solicit additional limitation in federal dollars. Our plan had been to use whatever existing state tobacco tax or general fund dollars, whichever we had, as the match, not to ask for any more of that, but to only perhaps come in and expand that limitation. But we didn't want to do that to put those dollars into our budget until we had a plan that, that we thought was workable from our standpoint as well as the federal government standpoint.
Any further questions?
Well, Madam Chair, I would move approval of the CF insurance program as recommended by staff with the $3 million reduction.
Representative Ross has moved the insurance pool governing board budget House Bill 5035 as recommended by the LFO staff, the reduction of $3 million. I guess we have in front of us figures here.
We have some proposed amendments that show you the final the changes. And then the first page, the bottom line, the first page of this spreadsheet shows you the final numbers. Actually, there is also a 20, as recommended, but also have a $20,657 reduction in the
regular insurance pool governing board program.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, my motion would include the proposed amendments to 1535 as proposed by staff.
And with the 4% efficiency.
With the 4% efficiency, which are
$20,657. That's something else.
Okay.
That's
the
total line.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It's a 4% savings of $20,657.
Representative Ross has moved the LFO recommendation. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, Hospital 5035 has passed. So,
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 5035 to the full committee with a detached recommendation.
Representative Gross has moved House Bill 5035 as amended to the full committee with a due-passed recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. This time, House Bill 5035 is moved to the full committee with a due-passed recommendation. Do we have any... And we will open a work session on House Bill 1529. This is the entire VHR budget. However, today we will be dealing with the Office of Medical Assistance Program. And helping out the working for the
I was going to ask that question.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, last time I had a separate memo, and since we got confused going back and forth between the memo and the spreadsheet, so to avoid that, I'm just going to go right down the spreadsheet. On the top two pages is a summary of all of the changes that take place on the prior worksheets that are broken out by program. The Office of Medical Assistance Programs, if you'll remember, is broken out into four units. There is the health plan Medicaid unit, the CHIP program, the non-health plan medical programs, and the administration program. The top two sheets that summarize the summary totals have all of the adjustments on there that are on the back sheet. The back sheets are there for your reference if you want to isolate one of those programs at some time. If you'll start with the second page, where you can see down at the bottom of the first page is the governor's recommended budget. This budget has, as you can see, a lot of puts and takes in it, getting from the legislatively approved up to the current service level, and then down to the governor's recommended. And for there you can see that the governor proposed reducing the line of services, eliminating eligibility, changing the date of eligibility from the date of application to the date of eligibility that eligibility is determined. There was a proposed reduction that was going to be an efficiency savings related to reducing errors in the eligibility process. There was a temporary reduction of poverty level women and children back down to 133% of the poverty level, and he temporarily reduced the Pell Grant students. But you can see that next to those next three, the fee-for-service CPI
there is a corresponding tobacco tax increase. So later on, he had restored those with the continuation of the 10-cent tobacco tax. And if you move down, he had originally eliminated those cost-based reimbursements for both A and B hospitals, but restored part of that on the next line by restoring the type reimbursement for type A hospitals with tobacco tax restoration, maintenance of the 10-cent tax again. Then he added with that 10-cent tax some interpretive services. Then he does a transfer of the mental health section of the bill out to the mental health department, where it, in fact, has been administered, and where the mental health contracts are pretty much as they were before being part of the health plan. And skipping on down, he adds about $4 million total funds, a little under $800,000 for phase one of the replacement of the Medicaid Management Information System. And that phase one is the planning phase for that. Then he has a package that funds some physician reclassifications in OMAP administration that have been recommended on the basis of a desk audit by the Department of Administrative Services. And then there are the inclusion of just under $800,000 in general fund and corresponding federal fund increases related to requests in the director's office that would have funded those. And then there are some contract adjustments between that relate to the pass-through money from the Commission on Children and Families, and those are sort of almost technical changes with pass-through. So if you'll turn to the second page, I'll go down the LFO recommendations related to OMAP. The first line simply shows you for information purposes and so that my numbers will come to the right amount at the bottom, or meaning that objectively, not subjectively, of course, that the first line is the adjustment that the agency had requested related to the rebalance in May. So that is the famous reshoot number. The reason that is a negative is because, remember, in their rebalance, they had requested to send general funds and carry forward tobacco taxes, and that's why you see general fund savings and tobacco tax increase. The savings are greater than the amount they were going to spend, and those savings were then used elsewhere in the budget in the reshoot to balance other divisions. Our first recommendation is based on what actually happened in the rebalance, and that was that you disappropriated those general funds, and the agency was to spend the tobacco taxes in the 97-99 biennium as had been originally planned. And therefore, what we do is restore that general fund in the current biennium. So the $4,951,559 is restoring the amount of money that had been disappropriated from the plan last biennium. And because they were to spend the tobacco tax last biennium, they don't have that to carry forward, so there's a fund shift there. The next recommendation is grown out of the agreement, the Medicaid upper limit agreement for reimbursing the district nursing homes, and this was an agreement that the date of eligibility would be restored to the date of application, and that restores those dollars. The next line is the restoration, which also grew out of that agreement, of cost-based reimbursement for Type B hospitals. That adds the $1.2 million that's on the next line. And the next line, we recommend that you not approve the enhancement for interpretive services that had been proposed with the 10-cent extension of the 10-cent tobacco tax, primarily because that is an enhancement to the existing level of service. And on the following line, what you see is simply the fund shift that allows that to become a general fund saving.
In other words, if you don't spend that tobacco tax money on enhanced interpretive services, you can spend it on your basic program and free up $2 million of general funds. So that's what that next line is, fund shift. The next line is the addition of $8.9 million to a general fund to offset a projected a shortfall in tobacco tax revenue compared to what budget looked like when it was presented. And the next line, several lines are proposed reductions, and I hope you all have a different sheet from the one, oh no, from the one I have. You do. So, anyway, the next line shows $5.3 million being eliminated due to the change of liquid assets from 5,000 to 2,000. And then the next line is the residency verification, a reduction of a little over $400,000, and this relates to House Bill 2700 and some of the provisions in House Bill 2700 that don't place a geographic or a time limit on, well, they do it geographic in the sense that you've got to be an Oregonian and you've got to live in Oregon, but they don't place a durational limit on residency. But the agency felt that with some of the provisions in House Bill 2700, there would be a savings associated with having to provide evidence of residency.
So there's no residency limit. I mean, there's no established residency period.
No.
Oh, no. That's just document for verification.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Then the next line is
and so they have to present some kind of documents to verify that they are in fact bona fide residents. My brother just can't come up from Texas, stay with me, and have his heart surgery and go back home.
He works it out right at night. The new regulations are going to keep him from doing that.
Okay, but my question really is not whether my brother can have his surgery here, but my question is about the homeless population, and in working out the verification, did we take into account that we have some homeless individuals who would have a different level of substantiation if they impact their Oregon residents?
I don't think they'd have a different level, but there is a list of things that they could produce in order to verify. A voucher, I think, a shelter voucher is one of them. And so there's a long list of items that they could produce.
There are in fact ways that homeless persons can substantiate the fact that they are here and they came here.
I believe so.
I haven't seen 2700 recently, but the list was fairly long of opportunities for showing that you were a resident. And I think the agency has discretion nonetheless when they are determining eligibility. I don't think 2700 precludes eligibility
from making a reasonable decision. Thank you. That's the only question I
heard
about that.
Thank you. Is there anything that I have heard from people who are trying to ascertain whether they are Oregon residents and the use of the health plan as a criticism of our lack of having a residency time period? And I'm just wondering, when we say a person's a resident, what qualifications is necessary to say that you're a resident?
Madam Chair and Representative Wilson, there was a recent Supreme Court decision in California, and this was discussed with the Legislative Council, and how that Supreme Court decision would relate to some interests that have been expressed in setting a durational residency requirement, such as 3 months or 6 months or a year. According to Legislative Council,
the basis of that Supreme Court decision was that the citizens are citizens not only of the state, but they of the country, but of the state, and they have the right to free travel. So moving to the state and declaring that your intention to be a citizen is, according to that Supreme Court decision, the right of U.S. citizens to do. So what House Bill 2700 does is say, yes, you have that right, and the determination of your eligibility for the health plan would like to see some evidence that you really have determined that you want to be a citizen of the state. And then it has a long list of things like, I can't remember all of them. I think there were rent receipts, a driver's license, an ID card, a utility bill, things.
But if a person crosses the border into Oregon then, and they go and apply for assistance, are they immediately accepted because they're a U.S. citizen?
I wouldn't say they're not immediately accepted because there are checks on their income. There's a process that has to determine their eligibility, and you find out a lot about a person just in that process.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the California determination had to do with cannabis eligibility,
mm-hmm.
and whether you could have discriminate among people based on their residency for your TANF benefits, and the determination there was that you could not.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I think that the 1996 Welfare Reform Act had actually given, in the Act, the Congress had given the ability to do that, and the Supreme Court decision said that Congress does not have the right to abridge the travel rights of citizens. So
the record I see that is a weak part of our plan is because I think it is used, and I have a doctor who tells me that all the time. And every time I see him, he says, have you done anything about the residency requirement for the Oregon Health Plan? Because people are using it who should not be using it, come into the state and leave shortly thereafter.
And we're going to welcome that. That's something that I learned as well from several physicians who did various kinds of surgeries,
mm-hmm.
believing, and actually did report that to the Office of Medical Assistance,
mm-hmm.
That these people came and they believed they were not residents.
Mm-hmm.
But that is why during the session and the interim, there's been a work group, and we feel still some of the amendments that we've made in 2700 will help strengthen it as much as we can. But we really, because of this lawsuit, the Supreme Court decision,
mm-hmm.
We're really kind of prohibited because some of the people in our plan are the Medicaid eligible who are eligible throughout the United States. And even though we have a waiver and we increase we cover more people because HCFA looks over it. I mean, you don't have to give their blessing and the Supreme Court decision. This is the best we can do.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, Madam Chair, I want to ask Peggy, what is the status of House Bill 2700? Where is it?
I believe that it is waiting to be heard on the Senate floor.
It did pass out of the rules on the Senate floor.
The Pell Grant students, the next line would eliminate coverage for Pell Grant eligible students. And then the following line, I think we might have some old worksheets, but the following line, if you have a reduction for adult dental service, it should not be there. Because the next line then is the treatment of $1 million, reduction of $1 million for treatment procedure review, and this is also related to House Bill 2700, where the Health Services Commission is strongly encouraged to review some of the treatment procedures associated with the conditions that are covered to see if there are ways that they can come up with
with savings without jeopardizing the services. This was done once before with the dental services, where the Health Services Commission looked at the treatment and was able to reduce the budget, I think, about two interims ago, somewhat related to, for instance, how often they might see someone for a certain condition. Maybe they might set eyes less seldom. I mean, not less seldom, more seldom than they do. Less often than they might otherwise. For instance, in the dental, it went from a 6-month examination to a year, once a year examination.
Oh.
The next line is eliminates non-Medicaid reimbursed services in the health plan. The next line is a line that reflects the $3 million of savings in the FIAP program. Because those tobacco tax dollars are not being used, they can be moved over to the health plan and be used in the health plan, and that's the way you free up the $3 million of general fund.
So, Madam Chair, does this mean we reduce money available for FIAP?
In the FIAP work plan, the budget that was just passed out, there was a $3 million reduction. And that, since FIAP is a tobacco tax-funded program, those tobacco taxes are then moved over and become available, because they're dedicated to the health plan, they become available to fund the Medicaid program in the health plan, which frees up $3 million of general fund.
We were going to eliminate FIAP, which is about the $24 or $5 million program, and just reduce it by $3 million. So we've retained
The FIAP program, the only change that was made just earlier in today's meeting was an administrative reduction of 4% in the Insurance Pool Governing Board program and a $3 million reduction on the FIAP program, but no particular limits placed on the program in terms of the number of people it can serve, but being left up to the board how they can best maximize the services with a $3 million reduction.
Another question. So that means we keep the current members under FIAP and not accept any new members?
It means that the board can accept new members if they can maximize federal funds, if they can reduce their administrative costs, and if they can maximize employer contributions in such a way and in such a mix, they may be able to keep the employee covered persons that they have now, and they may be able to replace them. They may not be able to replace them as they naturally fall off through attrition because they don't qualify anymore. They may not be able to fill those vacancies as fast as they might otherwise have, but they would still be able to fill them. So under the proposal that was passed out, the program does not go away. In any event, this is the fund shift that frees up the general funds associated with that reduction. The next line adds other funds and federal funds that are associated with the pass-through of Oregon Health to Oregon Health Sciences University of graduate medical education dollars. The other fund dollars come from OHSU, and then they are matched with the federal dollars, and they go back to OHSU. If you'll remember, they've agreed out of some of those dollars to fund $7.5 million in the mental health budget for the maintenance of the Oregon State Hospital, maintaining operating levels of the Oregon State Hospital. And that was in your mental health budget that you passed. The next line is a reduction of $200,000, a little over, for reductions in the department, the director's office prorate. These reductions relate to the reduction that you made in the director's office desktop package. You reduced it from $3 million to $2 million. And then they also reflect reduced prorate costs because of the 4% cuts that you took in the director's office. The next lines are reductions in OMAP administration. They eliminate all overtime and shift differentials. They cut printing and distribution costs and have the agency provide the provider guide on the internet. And I do not spell guide.
Those fingers are flying.
In any event, that cuts the printing and distribution costs, but still makes the guide available to the provider. The next line is a reduction in services and supplies budget, would reduce office expenses by 9% and publicity by 10%. And then what I did after that was to look at all of the discretionary administrative expenditures. More than half of OMAP's administrative budget is pass-through dollars, where somebody is passing through money to manage. And what I did was exclude those things over which they have no control or little control, such as their pass-through dollars or their state government assessment dollars, and said, well, you know, after taking these other reductions, how much would I need to take to equal 4% of those of what's left? And that's what that $75,000 does. It achieves the 4% target on their discretionary administrative expenditures. And the final recommendation is that you go ahead and approve the phase one component of the Medicaid Management Information System, but that you move that from the Office of Medical Assistance Programs to the Director's Office, Office of Information Systems, under Mr. Petty, who manages that office. And then tomorrow when we deal with budget notes, we'll be proposing a budget note that would suggest that the report at least quarterly to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, that they assure that they are keeping the users of the ultimate Medicaid Management Information Systems actively involved in the planning phase, and that they incorporate prior to coming with a phase two recommendation for the next legislative session, that they have a quality assurance review of the phase one process. And I'll have a written budget note that we'll bring tomorrow when we deal with all the other notes. And Madam Chair, that's the recommendation from him.
I know these have been hard decisions, and I just wanted to briefly state my objection to eliminating the Pell Grant eligible students, because that is a concern, and there are, most of these students are not young, happy college students. Most of them are, or many of them are parents of children who are seeking an education to improve their lives, and I want to just briefly state that. The second question I had of staff is eliminating the non-Medicaid services, is that actually a net savings to the program? It's my understanding that a large portion of that is abortions, and that if the plan has to go ahead with the delivery and the medical care associated with those infants, that that's not actually a net savings.
Madam Chair, and then to the subcommittee, if you look at the actuarial cost, the actuarial cost has been reported at, I believe, $2.6 million associated with that. It depends on what one's assumptions are about what will happen, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the actuarial cost is based on the assumption that 25% of the people involved would have their children and 75% would not. And this assumption is assuming that most of those people would probably go ahead and have the procedures done anyway, but the state would not pay for them.
Mm-hmm. But assuming with those assumptions, would we have the savings?
if you ha- if there were the assumption that let's say we're talking about abortion, this is been a minimal cost so far. If you were to assume that the persons involved were going to have their abortions anyway elsewhere, or that they were going to pay the full cost, then the state would have these savings.
Right. But our best projection is not that. It's that only a portion of these people would secure abortion welfare.
I don't know that there's any best guess on that.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I want to voice my opposition to this particular item because I think, as staff has pointed out, it is a belief. It is not, it's difficult to prove how many people would choose to have abortions elsewhere, how many would be able to pay for it, or how many would secure abortions, and how many would end up having the Oregon Health Plan pay for their delivery and birth. I just want to say that I think this is really a statement against abortion rather than cost savings, because I don't believe ultimately it ends up. My own personal view is that as much as I regret abortions, I don't think they're a happy event for anyone, that I do believe that people on the Oregon Health Plan should have this service available. I recognize that is not a view that is held by all persons, and I respect the people who don't agree with that. But I would oppose eliminating this for two reasons. First of all, I don't think it's a net savings. And secondly, I think that abortions are a legal procedure and they should be available to people in the Oregon Health Plan as well as others.
Well, I would just like to follow up on that myself. We're reducing the amount because that is the amount that we know it is costing the Oregon Health Plan at this point in time. And we're not going to speculate, I guess, on what else it might cost us. And we very possibly could find that it does cost the state more. However, it is a statement, and I think the statement is that there are people that do disagree with the procedure and really don't want their tax dollars spent in this way. And so that is that's one of the reasons that we have produced this number here. It's the actual number that being stands at this point in time.
Right.
And so
right. And
we're
and
removing that.
Say that there is a difference of opinion about this.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to take my opinion.
Thank you.
Although this may pertain to abortion, some may oppose this, whether or not they approve of abortions, but some simply don't think that we can afford to fund it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not a statement necessarily against the right to an abortion. I think it is a statement that there are some things that you afford on the health plan and some things you cannot.
I was not meaning that it was a statement about any right. That right exists. And anybody who even is covered by the Oregon Health Plan will still have that right. This does not inhibit their right whatsoever. It does nothing to their right. It just is eliminating the state paying for that. And so it's public funds, and we need to make decisions and choices about public funds.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm also concerned with the elimination of the money available for abortion. I think if women who choose to have an abortion just because they have low income, they cannot have access to the service, and I think that's not equal to the entitled to it if they're on medicine. So I would express my concern. But I am glad that we are restoring dental care for adults and restoring the CS money that I thought was going to be used to give. I'm glad we are restoring that.
Yeah, I think that I'm very pleased that we're able to do that as well. Any further comments or questions?
I was out of room for a minute, so I should limit my comments. I just have real concern about, and I was here when we put the Pell Grant back in last time for what are really non-traditional students that are poor and usually trying to maybe have a couple kids at home and trying to get a college education, get ahead. I have a real concern and objection to us doing away with that.
Well, I just want to comment on the Pell Grant issue. We are giving students in this state a real break. We're giving them a $15 million tuition freeze, and I think that is going to help a lot of students. We have increased the higher education budget, and so they are gaining something in another area. And many of the students, Representative Ross said they're not young and happy, so I guess they're old and unhappy. But I would disagree that they're not. Yeah, students usually do fall into a category of younger people, even though there are some differences. And if you go to a community college, the average age is a higher age. However, normally younger people have less health problems, and so. Just while this may not be a happy thing to do, it is, again, another decision that is made with the idea in mind that we're also helping them out in another way and with more dollars as well. So with that, I think we're going to stand at ease for just a moment and go get the next one. Yeah. Okay, Allison has made their recommendation. Senator Fisher?
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 5029.
No, just the OMAP portion.
Oh, the OMAP portion, okay.
Senator Fisher has moved the legislative fiscal office recommendations that we have just gone through on the first two pages of the, well, actually the second page of LFO, recommended adjustments. I'm sure just to review that the general fund, if you look up in the right-hand column of the side of the front page, there's a review of the recommended general fund of $620,811,796. That is a 4.8% increase over 97-99 estimated expenditures. That figure is a 23% reduction in current service level, but that's only because of the mental health transfer out. Otherwise, it would be about a 9% reduction. Then the it's about 1.4% less than the governor's recommended. And the other funds, tobacco taxes, are $219,278,742. The other funds, non-tobacco tax, are $90,990,924. Federal funds of $1,419,918,177. And a total budget of $2,999,639. This is a 2.1% increase. The primary reason that it's an increase is that the graduate medical education dollars that are flowing through from OHSU is the difference between having that increase and having the general fund and tobacco tax decrease. Okay, you've heard the figures and the motion. Is there a discussion?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask a question about Representative House Bill 2461. Did you guys have that in the Senate today, the tobacco tax bill, the 10-cent continuation?
No.
Okay, because we have a little concurrence problem in the House on that since it's got a sunset back on it and the cigar tax in it now, the cigar tax reduction, so.
You think it'll die because of that?
No, I think that it will have to go to the Conference Committee, and okay. So we need to make sure that we're in session for a few more days to get that through.
Okay, all right. Yeah, we will need that.
Yeah.
Well, the surcharge The 10 cent surcharge increase is not in here?
Senator Yee, the budget assumes continuation of the 10 cent tax.
Oh, assumes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
it
is
assumed in here, but the bill is not.
Yeah.
Not.
Okay. Yeah. Is there objection? The record will note. Senator Shields?
Did somebody move this?
Yeah. Senator Fisher moved it. And
okay, I'll be in there.
Okay. And Representative Ross.
Yeah. And I just wanted to state an explanation. I really appreciate the work that's been done on this, and I'm very happy about the continuation of CF and the adult dental. And my no vote is simply on those two items, the Pell Grant and the elimination of the non-medical services. And Brian, there's a factor overall.
I guess I'd like to comment, too, that I appreciate the work, and I don't want to repeat everything Representative Ross just said, but also, in addition to the Pell Grant issue and the non-Medicaid services, the liquid assets change I've heard from providers creates a lot of complication for them, a lot of paperwork, and really will not produce as many savings as we think it will. So that's part of my objection.
Well, providers. Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
I'll just say for the record that I do support the adjustment in the liquid assets change because I think that there is a need overall to contain this program, and I think that's a cost containment method that we should implement.
Okay. The Oregon Medical Office of Medical Assistance Program then portion of the DHR budget has passed.
Madam Chair, then tomorrow our plan is to bring the budget notes that have been proposed throughout the process of going through the work session. We will mark up the bill as it is to be amended, including our understanding that the committee would like to separate out the health plan costs within the bill. And so we will do that. There will be some of those amendments, and then we'll vote on the whole bill tomorrow, and we'll show you how it's affected the entire agency, and we'll also bring back the ad list that you've created so that you can have that available to beg from or something to know what you were interested in as you went through the process. This is the last of the Health Department of Human Resources.
And what about it?